Hope you had a nice weekend. Got very cold. We have a little taste of the cold. How you like it? While everyone else suffers, you're enjoying it. Okay, so far we have thought about manifolds and so curved spaces. We've decided how to measure distances on them using a metric. I've talked about tensors on them, so we can do algebra of tensors. I've talked about volume, so we can measure volumes. But we can't do any physics yet because we can't do calculus. So today we're going to learn how to do calculus on curved spaces. And that means we have to be able to differentiate. We need to take two objects, meaning, well, a tensor at two points, and take the difference, and take a limit as that difference goes to zero. And then we'll be able to do calculus. So we need to understand how to do calculus on curved spaces, i.e. differential geometry. And so to start off with, rather than just postulating something, let us begin with something very basic and try to learn from it. So as motivation, let us start from a variational principle. Okay, because we know that variational principles, when you vary the paths, give you differential equations. And so if we start from a good variational principle, we're bound to get a good differential equation. So as an example, let us take the action for a massive particle. And as we discussed before, the most natural action for a particle moving in space-time is simply the length of the world line. But now we're going to be measuring the length using this metric. So the path is x mu of lambda in some coordinate system. And you have to bear in mind that both x mu and lambda are arbitrary, okay? A little bit confusing, because you've got to pick some coordinate system x and then measure your particle in those coordinates. You've got to pick some parameterization lambda along the line, also arbitrary, provided it is monotonic. You don't want a parameterization which, you know, goes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Otherwise, it won't be 1 to 1. Same thing with the coordinates. They must be a 1 to 1 map from the space-time to Euclidean space. And so these x mu things are arbitrary, but which you can actually see in this action. So g mu, what is g mu nu? Well, g mu nu is the metric as measured at the point x of lambda. Okay, so this g mu nu, maybe let me just detail this. This is g mu nu at x of lambda. So I'm integrating along lambda. I have a coordinate at each lambda, which is the coordinate of the particle. I measure the metric. I figure out the metric there. And that's what goes into the action. And this action is obviously invariant under changing coordinates x, because the g will change in just such a way as to leave this invariant under changing the lambda, because there are two d lambdas in the denominator, one in the numerator. If I change lambda back into an arbitrary function of lambda, this is provided it's monotonic, it's still monotonic along the line, this will be invariant. Okay, so when I vary this action, the claim is that this g is going to represent gravity, that the effect of gravity on the particle is totally described by the fact that this g is not the flat metric. It's not eta mu nu, it varies in space. So let's vary this action. So I get a half from the square root. I get the square root 1 over the square root. When you vary a square root, you get the square root to the minus 1. And then you get the variation of everything inside the square root. So I vary the g, and I get delta x lambda. So the variation here means S of x plus delta x minus S of x. That's the meaning of it. And so to first order in delta x, I vary the g. Just take the derivative with respect to lambda and multiply by delta x lambda. And then I have dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. And now I must vary the dx d lambdas. So I get twice d delta x mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. Okay, so now we notice something nice, which is, there's a d lambda here. Which is that, of course, this variation is completely independent of the parameterization lambda. This was independent of lambda. This one is 2. And the way it works is that I can use that square root to convert all these d lambdas into d taus. Okay, so note that d by d tau equals 1 over the square root. The d lambda. Okay, and tau is a quantity which is invariant under reparameterization, just because these d lambdas will cancel. So I can use this square root to convert everything in the integrand into d taus, including this guy. So this is minus mc integral 1 half d tau, and then minus g mu nu comma lambda delta x mu x dot nu x dot lambda. And I'm going to define d quantity d tau by definition is dot. Minus 2 g mu nu x dot mu delta x dot nu. And then, as usual with variational principles, we integrate by parts. And so this term becomes 2. Now, when I integrate by parts, I get a plus sign. Then I've got to differentiate g mu nu of x, which means I differentiate with respect to x and then differentiate the x dot alpha, x dot mu, delta x, nu. Okay, so I just integrated this delta x dot nu by parts, got a plus sign, changed the minus sign to a plus sign, differentiated the g, and got this term. And then I have another term where I differentiate that x dot nu. So plus 2 g mu nu x double dot mu delta x nu. So this is supposed to be 0 for all delta x. Here? This one? Oh, yes, sorry, you're right. Thank you. Thanks. Okay, and so this implies that g mu nu x double dot nu plus g mu nu comma alpha x dot nu x dot nu x dot alpha, sorry, minus 1/2 g mu nu comma mu lambda comma nu x dot mu x dot lambda equals 0. Okay, so I'm just equating the coefficient of delta x nu and dividing by 2. So the first two terms are these two, and then I have that one with the minus sign. And so g is invertible, and so this implies that x double dot mu plus, and then we're going to introduce this symbol, curly brackets, 1 upper index, 2 lower indices, x dot nu, x dot alpha equals 0, where the Christoffel symbol mu nu alpha is defined to be 1/2 g mu beta g nu beta alpha plus g alpha beta nu g nu alpha beta. Okay, so what I've done here is to rewrite this term as 1/2 of x dot mu, x dot lambda, and then symmetrize. Because this is symmetrical under mu and alpha, I can write this as g mu. My indices aren't matching up. That should be a new g mu. Sorry, it's the first term. Okay. Mu. Thank you. Okay. All right. So I symmetrize here. G. This is 1/2 g mu nu comma alpha plus g alpha nu comma mu. That's correct. Okay, so we see that the consequence of this variational principle is this equation, which is called the geodesic equation. And it's the gives the path followed by a curve. Well, it gives the curve which let's just write it that way, which extremizes the length, invariant length. So in Euclidean geometry, this curve would minimize the length, but in geometry with Minkowski spacetime as the local metric, there are various minus signs which come in. And actually, it turns out it maximizes the length for a time-like curve. It's the extremal curve. Now, notice that so it must be, because of the way we've derived things, it must be that this equation is invariant under coordinate transformations. But the individual pieces of it are not. But neither the acceleration d2x alpha d tau squared nor the Christoffel symbol are tensors. Okay, so the acceleration of the particle turns out not to be a tensor. And we can see how it fails to be a tensor. You see, if I have, let's try to work out d by d tau of x prime mu of tau. So what does that mean? I've got some curve. Tau is coordinate invariant, but x is certainly not. And so I had a x mu of tau. And if I change coordinates to some different coordinate system, this will be the path in the new coordinate system. Now, this is equal to dx prime mu dx alpha dx alpha d tau. That's easy to see because x prime mu, after all, is some function of x alpha. Let's write it here. The coordinates, the new path, is simply given by x prime mu of x alpha of tau. Okay, there is some coordinate transformation from x to x prime, which is this function. And so this is just the composition of a function. We take tau into the coordinates x, that's this function, and then we take x into x prime. So when I differentiate x prime with respect to tau, first I differentiate with respect to x alpha, that's this piece, and then I differentiate x alpha with respect to tau. Okay, so this is a vector. This does transform as a contravariant vector. Okay, it has one upstairs index, and it does transform under coordinate transformations as a contravariant vector. But if we take the acceleration, okay, this I get just by differentiating this right-hand side again. And here I've got to take the second derivatives of x prime with respect to x, dx alpha detour, dx beta detour. And then I differentiate this term. D2x alpha detour squared. Okay, so the second term looks right for a contravariant vector, but the first term is wrong. Okay, this is the wrong transformation law. However, the Christoffel symbol is not a four-vector either. It's not a tensor either. And its transformation law, you can easily work out, mu nu alpha prime. This is as a function of x prime. Okay, so to do that, I just take this expression, prime everything, plug in g prime is dx dx prime dx dx prime times g, do all the differentiations, and again, you'll get second derivative terms. And this is equal to mu dx alpha dx So that's the right transformation law. Sorry, that should be the Christoffel symbol. Plus dx prime mu dx lambda d2x lambda dx prime nu dx prime rho. That should be alpha. Am I? Sorry. One of those should not be alpha. Let's call it delta. Let's make sure I got that right. Yeah, I think that's right. Now, we're still not quite there in showing the terms cancel. What we want to show is that those two extra non-tensorial terms cancel. Note that this last term, so this is the bad term. This is the bad term. Notice dx prime alpha dx mu dx lambda dx lambda dx prime rho This is delta mu rho. Okay, just using the chain rule, if I differentiate x prime mu with respect to x prime rho, that's equivalent to differentiating x prime mu with respect to x lambda, and then x lambda with respect to x rho, and that's just delta mu rho. Okay, this is the Jacobian matrix and the inverse Jacobian matrix. Now we can differentiate this again with respect to x prime, and we get dx prime. So let's take d by dx prime nu of this equation, and we get dx lambda d2x lambda dx prime rho dx prime nu plus dx lambda dx prime rho dx alpha dx prime nu d2x prime mu dx alpha dx lambda equals 0. Okay, so when I'm taking d by dx prime, this is the easy term. And this term I then differentiate with respect to x and then put dx dx prime to get this term over here. And so what I see is that last term, in fact, let me just fix the indices so it agrees exactly. Let's make this one alpha. Nu is alpha, and then I better change this alpha to nu. Okay, so the last term, so the bad term, is minus dx lambda dx prime rho dx nu dx prime alpha d2x prime mu dx nu d lambda. Okay, so there are two equivalent ways of writing this last term. And if you use this form, you will see it precisely cancels this term in the geodesic equation. Okay, so the geodesic equation is perfectly coordinate invariant, but the way it works is that you have this quantity, the Christoffel symbol, which is not a tensor, and whose transformation is precisely such as to cancel the bad terms in the transformation of the acceleration. And so this equation here, emphasize this. This equation here is very important. Oops. Too high for me. This is the transformation law. Alpha, and you notice it has this nasty term in it. That is the model for a connection. That's what's called a connection. A connection is precisely something you introduce, which is not invariant or is not a tensor under coordinate transformations. It transforms with an extra term, and that extra term is precisely designed to cancel the bad transformation laws of the ordinary coordinate derivative. And this is really a theme in physics, in modern physics. The gauge theory involves exactly the same idea, where you have local transformations, which are phases which act on the wave function or on fields, where the field can change by a phase which is space-time dependent. This means that derivatives, ordinary derivatives of the fields, are no longer transform nicely under gauge transformations. So you introduce the vector potential A mu. It is not gauge invariant. It transforms in a particular way. And that way, that transformation precisely introduces, well, that allows you to define a covariant derivative which does transform nicely. Okay, so this is a very general idea. Well, let's say this is a very general theme. In modern physics. You can say that connections like this Christoffel symbol or the vector potential is also a connection, are not tensors. But they allow us to construct tensorial derivatives. And actually, Kevin Costello, I believe, is giving a course later this year on mathematical aspects of connections. In general. So it's a funny thing. It's again this theme in modern physics that we believe there are all these symmetries. We believe in entities which we don't know how to describe in actual coordinates. We have a picture, like a picture of a curved space. But we can't really do any calculations without some coordinates on the curved space. We know the coordinates are irrelevant, so there's the symmetry under changing all coordinates from one to another. Similarly, in gauge theories, we want to write down a wave function, we want to write down vector potentials, we want to write down Dirac fields. None of these are gauge invariant, they're all tensors under gauge transformations. And so somehow we have to introduce this redundancy into all these fields, which is the redundancy in coordinates we use, both on space-time and in the space of fields. And then we introduce derivatives which help us to, which allow us to define meaningful derivatives. And so we're always trying to work within this sort of fact that we can't really describe the entities in nature on their own terms. We can only describe them by introducing hugely redundant descriptions involving coordinates. Now, so the more general view in GR, let's say, in fact, mu nu alpha is only a special case of the general connection in general relativity, gamma mu nu alpha. And by definition, definition obeys the transformation law the same transformation law. I.e. gamma prime mu nu alpha equals, and then dx prime dx, dx dx prime, dx dx prime, gamma plus this extra term. D2x dx dx. Dx prime dx. I won't bother putting the indices in. It's exactly the same as the other equation. And so you introduce this gamma in general. It doesn't have to equal the Christoffel symbol. It could be more general. And we're going to discuss exactly the situation in which it reduces to the Christoffel symbol. But the main point of gamma, this allows us to ensure derivatives are tensors. Okay, so what we do is we define the covariant derivative . Okay, it's covariant because it has one covariant index. And the covariant derivative of some tensor with some upstairs indices and some downstairs indices, by definition, is the ordinary derivative . Okay, and then a plus gamma for every upstairs index for each contravariant index. And a minus gamma for every covariant index. Covariant index. So it's a plus gamma with A and a minus gamma with A. And now let me discuss how to put the indices in. So the safe rule is always to put the derivative index last on the gamma. Okay, so the derivative index always goes last. This term, which relates to upstairs indices, you just want to convert the upstairs index on A to an upstairs index on the gamma. Okay, so I put an alpha here and then a lambda lambda. Okay, so the gamma is going to, think of the gamma as hitting the upstairs index and converting it into the free index alpha. Likewise, here you've got a downstairs index, so we hit the downstairs index, this time with the upstairs index of gamma, and so on. Minus. Okay, you can check that this is a tensor. Okay, whereas the ordinary derivative is not a tensor, that's easy to see because in the transformation law for a vector, you'll have terms like dx prime dx. And then you go and differentiate it, well, you're going to have d2x prime dx squared in the transformation law, and the gammas precisely cancel all those bad terms. So that's the point of a connection. It allows you to do calculus. And it looks a bit arbitrary. Okay, because all I do is I have this connection, and all I know about it is it satisfies this transformation law. And that's correct. That is the general definition of a connection. Now, by the way, something which is usually ignored in most textbooks, but which is fundamentally important, note, it is fundamentally important that this connection is consistent, that gamma is consistently defined across all coordinate systems. Okay, so in particular, let's imagine that I have three coordinate systems. Okay, one of them uses the coordinates x, another one uses x prime, and the third uses x double prime. Well, you better check that if I go from x to x double prime directly, or if I go from x to x prime and then to x double prime, I get the same answer. Okay? Otherwise, you'd have incompatibility between the gamma. So we need to check that x to x prime to x double prime gives the same gamma double prime as x to x double prime. Okay, and in fact this is true. Can verify this. And if you want to see a book where this is done nicely, see Houston and Todd. Introduction to GR, which is in the library. So it's a little bit of painful algebra, but it's fundamentally important. Okay, and it's sort of sad that most books don't even mention it as an important check that you have a consistent connection. And by the way, it's exactly the same in a gauge theory. The only reason the transformation law of the gauge connection, let's say in non-abelian Yang-Mills, makes any sense is because there's a compatibility condition like this. This is actually sufficient if you show that a connection is compatible in the overlap region between three coordinate systems. That's what we're checking, right? We're checking that it's consistent in this region. So each of these coordinate systems is only valid. Maybe x is only valid here. Right, x prime, double prime, only valid there, x prime only valid there, but they have to be consistent in their overlap region, the regions where they all apply. And the transformation law of the non-abelian gauge connection is also satisfies this kind of consistency condition in the overlap regions. And that's fundamentally important, otherwise it wouldn't make any sense. No, it's true for any non-abelian gauge theory, and it's true for all connections defined this way in GR. Okay, so it's actually more general than the Christoffel symbols, and I'm just going to discuss now in what way it's more general than the Christoffel symbols, because in general, one can have a connection which has torsion, something called torsion. Let's look at that transformation law, which I didn't put any indices on. So let's look at this one instead. Let's look at the transformation law here. Note that the bad term call it bad, but it's really good because it allows us to define derivatives. But this bad term in the transformation law for gamma is symmetrical under the lower two indices. Okay, if we look at that term, the lower two indices are nu and alpha, and because partial derivatives commutes, this is symmetric. So it follows that if we define this quantity, which is just the difference between the connection with the two lower indices reversed, so it's proportional to the anti-symmetric part of gamma, that this is a tensor. Okay, because the bad term in the first piece and the second piece are going to cancel, because the transformation, the bad term is symmetrical under exchange of those indices, and so the two bad terms will cancel. So this is a tensor. It's called a torsion tensor. Okay, well, there's a big question in all of this. How do we determine gamma? We seem to have a lot of arbitrariness in gamma. Now, the basic postulate of Riemannian geometry. Let's see, what do I want to get rid of? Differential geometry. Is that the metric is covariantly constant. And it turns out that this equation is sufficient to fix the symmetrical part of gamma. The anti-symmetrical part of gamma is a tensor anyway, so it's a good thing, and it can just be whatever it is. But, and there's no constraint on this, except if I have some particular theory which fixes it. But the symmetrical part of the connection, will be fixed by this equation. Now let's try to motivate that formula. Why is it sensible to require that the metric is covariantly constant? So to see this, remember that we showed that with the coordinate transformation, I can always set the first derivatives of a metric equal to zero at any point. Okay, so recall, with a coordinate with an appropriate coordinate transformation, we can set the first derivative of a metric d mu g alpha beta equals 0 at any particular space-time point. If we impose covariant equals 0 in all coordinates, because it's a tensor equation, then we guarantee that the symmetric part equals 0. The symmetric part of the connection will be 0 in the above, in any coordinate system where g, where d mu g alpha beta equals 0. Okay, so the point is that if I, I want to preserve this idea that the manifold locally is like flat space. Okay, so I could show that I can always choose coordinates so that the first derivative of the metric is 0 at a point, and the metric in fact equals eta at that point. So in those coordinates, certainly looks like flat space as far as the metric goes. What you'd like to say is that all derivatives reduce to flat space derivatives too at that point. And since in constructing derivatives I use this gamma, well, I'd like the gamma to be 0 always in the same coordinate system. Now, there's a little fly in the ointment, which is this torsion is a tensor. Okay, so the torsion is sort of this thing which has a genuine existence on the manifold. And if it's not 0, it's a tensor, so you're not going to be able to set it 0 in any coordinate system. If a tensor is non-zero in one coordinate system, it cannot be 0 in any other coordinate system, right? So that's why we put this constraint on the symmetric part of the connection. So this condition is called metricity. It's also called metricity. And as I said, it's basically trying to impose that as far as possible, the space looks locally flat. Now let's see that this is true, that this equation guarantees that the symmetric part of the connection is 0. So let's prove this. First of all, we've got to write down that equation. I'm going to write it down like this. For some reason, I picked different indices. Alpha, beta, and gamma. So now we use just the trick we've used before. Now this covariant derivative, remember the derivative index always comes last. There are two lower indices on the metric, so you need two connection terms. The connection, first of all, hits the first index of G, and then hits the second index of G, beta, lambda, gamma. And so that's the first equation. Well, that is this equation. Okay, that's the equation that the covariant derivative of g is zero. Now we play our usual game of cycling the indices vertically. So alpha is going to go to beta, is going to go to gamma. Beta is going to go to gamma, is going to go to alpha. And gamma is going to go to alpha and then to beta. So I'll just write these out. Gamma beta g delta alpha, delta alpha gamma g delta beta gamma delta alpha beta g gamma delta delta beta gamma g alpha delta. Just the same equation written three times. Let's call this A, B, and C. Let me try and move this up.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
On this bottom board, when you say then guarantee that gamma in the subscript, should that be a square bracket?
No. I do want the symmetric. Okay. So. Sorry, let me just remind you, not sure I even said this, but if I've got some tensor, the antisymmetric part is defined to be a half gamma lambda mu nu minus gamma lambda nu mu. Okay, the symmetric part, so this would be one half the torsion.
You translate the torsion to zero, right?
Pardon?
No,
I want the symmetric part being zero. I'll explain. So the symmetric part is with the plus sign. Okay. So yeah, the argument is the following, that this torsion is a tensor. I should really think about it as an independent thing, apart from the metric. I mean, it's another tensor. It's entitled to live anywhere on the manifold. It's entitled to be not zero. If it's not zero, there is nothing I can do to set it zero, okay? Because it is a tensor object. The symmetric part of the connection is not a tensor. The symmetric part is the part with that ugly extra term. What I'd like to be true is that in any coordinate system where the metric has zero first derivative, I'd like the symmetric part of the connection to vanish. And then I can say that my covariant derivative reduces to the flat space derivative. At least the part of it, the symmetric part of the connection, reduces to the part of the covariant derivative involving the symmetric part of the connection reduces to the flat space derivative. Okay? So we'll see this in a moment. Okay? These are totally general, with torsion, without torsion. They're absolutely general. So now what we do is we take, we notice some of these terms are similar. So we take A plus B minus C. And what we get is d alpha g beta gamma plus d beta g gamma alpha minus d gamma g alpha beta. And then we get minus gamma. Now, it's useful, you see, because you have g's multiplying by these gammas, it's useful to define a gamma with all indices lower. And I put a dot in there to separate out the upper index, which got lowered from the other two indices. So this is going to be g alpha delta gamma delta beta gamma. Okay, so it's useful just to put all the indices down. And this is gamma beta alpha plus gamma gamma alpha beta minus gamma beta gamma alpha minus gamma beta alpha gamma minus gamma alpha gamma beta gamma alpha beta gamma. Why did I do it this way? Well, these two guys are torsion, right? Because they're both anti-symmetric. And this guy is the symmetric part of the connection. And so now you'll see that the connection gamma gamma beta alpha, which is this part. This index is wrong here. Alpha. Okay, so this is the symmetric part of the connection. That's equal to 1/2. See, this plus that would be twice the symmetric part of gamma. So the symmetric part of gamma is 1/2 d gamma g alpha beta plus d beta g alpha gamma minus d alpha g gamma beta. Okay, so I take this to the right-hand side. Seem to have minus sign somewhere. Here? Let me just see. Yeah, it's true. Yes, it's true. I don't know. Strange. Okay. Sorry, I must have been. It's obvious from here that it's d alpha beta gamma plus d beta gamma alpha minus d gamma alpha beta. And then we've got these torsion terms, okay, plus 1/2 the torsion, because that's a factor of 2, 1/2 the torsion beta alpha gamma plus 1/2 the torsion alpha beta gamma. And this leads to IE. Well, let's leave them with lowered indices. But you see, if the torsion is 0, I'm getting back the Christoffel symbol. All right, so if I raise this index with a metric, this will give me exactly the Christoffel symbol. So this I can write as g alpha gamma or g alpha mu, Christoffel symbol, mu beta gamma. Now, it follows that, this is just the symmetric part of gamma. It follows, of course, the total gamma is the symmetric plus the antisymmetric piece. If I just add the symmetric and antisymmetric pieces, I get the original gamma. And so the total connection gamma alpha beta gamma is equal to 1/2. Alpha, that should be In fact, let's just write it this way. G gamma mu Christoffel mu beta gamma plus 1/2. And this is now torsion beta dot alpha gamma plus here. I think I have a wrong sign here too, I'm afraid. I think, sorry about this. Let's see, I took the symmetric part over here. Alpha gamma is correct. Alpha beta, no, that's correct.
The first equation there should be 2 plus and the last.
Sorry?
And the last
two. These two?
The first one. The equation about the that equation, the
It should be minus minus gives a plus.
Should that be plus plus gamma beta gamma? The last two like brackets outside additional plus.
Oh, actually, oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, good point. Because there was a minus here. Looks like it. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Must be. Okay.
So the bottom of the last Christoffel assumption, I think should be beta alpha.
Okay. Thanks.
The most recent thing you're no after that.
This one.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry, it's a bad day for indices. Say again? Yeah. Oh, this looks wrong. Phew. This looks totally wrong. This is beta alpha. Yeah, sorry?
Christoffel symbol, mu beta gamma. The gamma is not a downstairs index, it should be up there, right?
Oh, you're beta alpha. Yes, you're right. Sorry. Alpha, and this one is gamma. Phew. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so gamma is this guy. Hopefully this result is correct. Beta, alpha, gamma. T. I need to put a dot in there. Okay. So this quantity is a combination of the torsion tensor. So all I've done here is start from the symmetric part of gamma and add the anti-symmetric part of gamma, which gives me another torsion tensor. Gives me this guy, I believe. And this guy is called a contortion tensor. Does it have a, I think it's bad English, because torsion has an S, and contortion should, of course, have a T. But anyway, mathematicians are not too hot on English. This is the contortion tensor, and it's called K. Beta, alpha, gamma. It is a tensor. Now, why did I go through all this, put you through all this contortions? The reason is that torsion does arise in some theories of fields coupled to general relativity. In fact, in general, if you couple fermions to general relativity and you write down the field equations, you discover that the torsion is not zero. Okay, it's very small. It turns out to be it's very small. It's the experimental constraints on it are minuscule, I mean, there are very few experimental constraints on such theories, but this torsion could certainly be there. I'm quite excited about it at the moment because it turns out that in supergravity, n equals one supergravity in four dimensions, such terms are generally present, and they actually have a very important effect. They seem to cause the universe to avoid the initial singularity. So the scale factor of the universe comes close to zero and then bounces. So that's very significant, only discovered within the last year, but it rests on the idea of allowing torsion to be there. So this torsion could be very important.
Excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're saying you have zero alternative torsion, that doesn't really make sense, right? Because this data text shows up in the Bianchi identities.
Yeah, so you have to modify the Bianchi identities by the presence of the torsion.
Yeah.
And you have to modify the Riemann tensor by the presence of the torsion. No, it makes perfect sense. What it says is that you start with an action principle and you live with the consequences. Okay? So when you write down an action principle for general relativity coupled to fermions, basically the connection appears in various places. You have to, roughly speaking, take the square root of the metric to define a derivative on Dirac fields, because they only have one derivative. To define the gamma matrices. Gamma matrices, you know, are not tensors. These are just fixed matrices. So what you do is you take the metric and you write this as in terms of what's called a Feierbein. Okay, and this is essentially the calculation we already did to figure out these k's. We showed you could factorize the metric into, you know, it's an orthogonal matrix, so you can diagonalize it, set it equal to 1. These e's are the matrices which diagonalize the metric and set the diagonal values to minus, plus, minus 1, plus 1, etc. So you write this down, and then you define a gamma matrix, which is this. And this is now... this basically converts the, I wrote it the wrong way around. Gamma A, B, eta A, B. This is now an object with a real four-vector index. So you could think about it as if it was a gamma mu. It's a covariant vector. And you can define the Dirac equation using this object. When you do this, and you write down your action, you vary the action, you find the equations of motion, in general, you will discover there is torsion. And this torsion is indeed quite interesting. But in most of the textbooks, you will find people just set the torsion equal to zero as a choice, because in some ways that's a minimal choice. So the statement is the following. If the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, it's just a special case. Of course, zero is a special case of being totally anti-symmetric. Then the contortion tensor equals the torsion tensor. Did I define it to be k? Yeah, k equals t. And the symmetric part of the connection is the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so that's the general statement. But it relies on this assumption that the torsion is totally antisymmetric. It might be zero. The simplest assumption is the torsion is zero, and then the connection, then this metricity implies that the connection is the Christoffel symbol.
Equals zero. Does that follow from like you can choose a frame where the torsion exactly cancels?
No, you can't. You see, if the torsion is not zero, it's a tensor.
Yeah.
You can't pick a frame in which it is zero.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah. You can set the symmetric part.
Yes.
Is that why your claim is?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is that yeah, so we actually need to modify the statement a little bit. If the torsion is totally antisymmetric, or zero, right? So if you can ignore torsion, then this equation guarantees that the symmetric part of gamma is zero in any coordinate system where the derivatives of the metric are zero. So we showed we could choose a coordinate system in which this is zero, right? This equation guarantees, in the absence of the torsion term, that the...
The symmetric part can't also be zero if the torsion is zero, right? Because then the whole connection is zero.
Yes. It is.
Oh.
Exactly what you want.
Oh, I see, okay.
You want that the whole connection is zero.
In flat space?
You want locally the space to look flat.
Yeah, okay.
So what you want is that if ever I choose a coordinate system in which the first derivatives of the metric are zero, then the derivative, the covariant derivative, reduces to the flat space derivative. And that's what this guarantees.
That follows from this last equation with the appropriate frame.
Yes, yeah, it follows from, yes. So this implies, in fact, let's do this. So if the torsion is totally, let me just get this right. If the torsion is totally antisymmetric, then this vanishes if T beta gamma alpha is totally antisymmetric. And this ensures that if D beta G mu alpha equals zero, then the connection is zero.
So this original statement didn't require the torsion antisymmetric, though.
Pardon? Yes.
It doesn't.
No, the original one does. I put it in there now. Okay. This is the original statement. All right, sorry. Probably I introduced too much. Let us start from the basics. Let's assume the torsion is zero. Okay? We can always come back and consider the torsion. Let's start from assuming the torsion is zero. If I just assume the torsion is zero, then what this calculation has shown is that the Christoffel symbol, the connection equals the Christoffel symbol, right? The Christoffel symbol obviously vanishes in any coordinate system in which the first derivatives of the metric are zero. Okay, so with the assumption of zero torsion, I have this very nice picture that locally the metric is Minkowski, its first derivatives vanish, and the Christoffel symbols vanish. And so that derivatives are just the flat space derivatives. All I've done here is to generalize that to the case when torsion is there. And you see there is still a case in which the derivatives reduce to the flat space derivatives, and that's when this contortion tensor is zero. So it is a generalization of the condition of the torsion being zero. You see, it's not necessary for the torsion to be zero, it's only necessary for the contortion to be zero.
Why can't you use this bottom equation to set the symmetric bar of the connection equals zero, even in the case where the torsion is not completely anti-symmetric?
I'm sorry. I think I can remove those two things, can't I? Yeah, sorry. I think you're right. I think I can just do that.
This bottom equation, if you take the frame for the torsion exactly cancels the Christoffel symbol, then you can make the symmetric part zero, I think, right? But in general, you don't require anti-symmetry of the torsion.
Yeah, but you're canceling a non-tensorial object with a tensorial object, so this is clearly not a, that can be done maybe in some certain coordinate system somewhere, but it's not really clear that this always works.
Yeah, I think that was a statement, though, it was in some coordinate system, right?
Yeah. The statement is that in any coordinate system where the first derivatives of the metric are zero, the connection also vanishes. And it relies on two things. It relies on this metricity, and it relies on the torsion being totally anti-symmetric. Yeah.
The anti-symmetric property of the torsion, is that referred to the lower indices of the torsion? Because now we have...
Yes, it is. You see, when it's totally anti-symmetric, it means anti-symmetric under all three indices. All three.
There's
a contradiction. Thank you. Sorry. Let me just check for the statement.
I think the left thing is correct and the right thing is correct.
Yeah.
So the contortion does not torsion if
No, you're right.
I guess.
I'm sorry. You're right. So it actually is this. It is this. I'm sorry. I'll straighten this out at the beginning of next time. I'm sorry about that. Let's see. The statement is that if the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, then the contortion... equals the torsion, I'm sorry. Yep, sorry. Equals the torsion. It's the torsion. I think this is the correct statement. Okay.
So it's with the equals zero. Shouldn't that be now equals the Christoffel symbol?
That's what you're saying over here. So I'm
sorry. So,
yeah, I think this is the right.
Yeah, but now it equals zero over there. The middle board.
No, I put a brackets here. They're brackets.
I'm in the middle board.
Okay. There.
Yeah. You have a symmetric part equals zero there, and symmetric.
Yeah, symmetric part is zero, symmetric part is zero, symmetric part is zero.
Plus symmetric part is... Yeah, the thing is you can only,
with a choice of coordinates, you can only touch the symmetric part. The anti-symmetric is always the coordinates with the center. You cannot change that with coordinates, right?
I'm trying to figure out what's the extra assumption here, because here you have totally asymmetric, the connection is a Christoffel symbol. Here
yes.
You have the symmetric part of the connection is zero.
No, I don't. Where did I removed all that.
The middle board.
Where?
Then guarantee that.
Yeah, there's symmetric.
Yeah, this is a symmetric part also.
Yeah.
I have symmetric everywhere.
Right, but here equals zero and here equals
zero. No. But
you know, I picked a coordinate system in which the first derivatives of the metric are zero.
Okay.
So Christoffel's symbol is zero.
I see, okay.
It's completely consistent.
Okay, so
any other questions? Yeah.
How should I understand the torsion physically?
Well, I think, as you said, I mean, the torsion is a tensor, right?
So think of the torsion as something which lives in space-time. It exists. It has to be defined by some field equation. It's not really geometrical in the same sense as the metric or the Christoffel symbol. It has a sort of independent existence. Somebody's got to tell you what is the torsion. You're not going to change it with coordinate transformations, except in the same way as you change tensors. And if it's not zero, you can never set it zero with a coordinate transformation. So it's some additional thing which floats around on space-time. Now, if you don't want to think about it, and some people don't like to think about it, then just set it zero. But that is an arbitrary choice. The point I'm making is that is an arbitrary choice. When you define derivatives with connections, you have the freedom to put an extra thing in, which is this torsion. And as you said, nothing to do with coordinate transformations really affects it. So when you make statements like this, that metricity guarantees derivatives reduced to flat space derivatives, you need to take the torsion out of that statement. The torsion is always there, just sort of interfering with such statements, and you can't. There's nothing you can do to remove it if it's there.
Does the torsion give us a preferred tonicity, at least locally?
Yes, it does.
So it's a very interesting thing. I probably get this equation wrong, but if you ask what it is equal to, if you put fermions in, it turns out that the equations of motion typically give you something like this. Where this is the spin matrix. Okay, and so this, for example, you'll find in Kibble's paper of 1960. That he introduced first-order formalism, what's called first-order formalism, where you have this E, and you also have another connection. You replace gamma and G with E and omega, which is called a spin connection. And in that formalism, you generally find that the torsion is given by a quantity like this. It turns out in this case that the torsion is totally antisymmetric, and so the contortion equals the torsion, and then it turns out that you do have this nice property that the symmetric part of the connection is always zero if the first derivative of the metric is zero. But it is totally related to this is called the spin density of particles. So that's the reason why it's so small, is it's very hard. If we were able to cram a lot of particles into the same region of space, into a small region of space-time, and get all their spins to line up, then the torsion would be large in this theory. But generally, it's very small. That's the spin current. That's right. That's a spin current.
So if the contortion was non-zero, then even when the first partials vanish,
yes,
the connection would be non-zero, right? So is there a way to physically interpret that?
If the contortion is
non-zero,
yes,
then even though you can set the symmetric part, yeah. So
right.
Is there a way to physically understand that even in flat space you have like this non-zero connection?
I think it's... Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you. except to say, yeah, that there are these theories of gravity which predict this, which predict that the fermions change the connection locally by some kind of term.
There is maybe a slight misconception. I mean, you can think about these, the torsion field, as something living on a Riemannian manifold, but what you can also do is you can think about a Riemann-Hartmann manifold, and this is a manifold that carries both curvature and torsion. You know, so torsion takes the same place as some different kind of curvature tensor, and on this geometry, you have a prescription how to calculate the torsion in terms of your connection and this E field over there, this E beam.
That's right. Yeah, it's this description.
That torsion comes from spinners, and this is always this thing that you take something like GR where you only have curvature and you add something and then, you know, you get that. But if you want to talk about, you said just a flat space, and you know, if you are a Riemann-Hartmann manifold and you say you just want to have a flat space, then you still have non-vanishing torsion by definition. So the mathematical arena, so to speak, is larger.
That's what I was saying. I was just asking if there's a way to interpret that. Because I mean,
I don't think it's a geometrical way. You know, it's not a curved manifold. It's a curved manifold with this extra piece of the connection living on it. And the extra piece of the connection is due to the fermion's spin. That's what this equation is telling you. That the fermion spin current creates this extra part of the connection. Okay, that was just intended to be a little glimpse of something slightly beyond GR. I think I better stop. Are there any other questions? Okay. I mean, maybe the point to emphasize is that when you study the conventional picture of GR without torsion, you know, there's this very nice physical picture that you have a curved space and it has a metric, and the derivatives are uniquely defined by this metricity condition and so on and so forth. We know that picture is wrong. Okay, we know that picture is wrong because the Big Bang is the case where the metric vanishes. It's not an invertible matrix anymore. We know that the Riemann curvature goes to infinity there. The same is true inside black holes, that it must be that this geometrical picture of space-time breaks down. And so it's very interesting to try to see what changes you can make to that picture, even if it's a good rough approximation. This geometrical picture may only be a rough approximation. There may be a more fundamental theory, and then, of course, you know, what is its? How do we intuitively understand that more fundamental theory? That's a big question. But I really wanted to just point you to the fact there are generalizations of that picture, and they are extremely interesting. But I think they have yet to be sort of physically interpreted in the same way. We, you know, even though this geometrical picture is so appealing, it is wrong. We're pretty confident it is wrong. Okay, because it breaks down. I mean, any theory that generates singularities where the differential equations make no sense must be wrong. So it's really very important to keep an open mind and look at these alternatives. Okay.